Morai v'rabotai. What Rabbi Shammah meant that these presentations are designed specifically for this audience, what that means really was, I had suggested three topics, he rejected every one of them, and instead suggested three topics for me. And I'm delighted to try to do that, but we'll see what happens. I'm not sure why I've spoken here many times in the past. When I usually just present one presentation, we get a large group, but when it's a series of three, usually it's a much smaller group and rather specialized. And I'm surprised by the number of people who are here. And I attribute it to... are the mics working? Can you hear me now? I'll just... It may be that there are more Ashkenazim here than the Sfaradim. I really don't know. And I'm mentioning that because last night was Nittel night for Ashkenazim, and that meant that many of you didn't learn Torah, and that might be the reason why some of you showed up tonight. I'm not sure. Can you hear? Okay. I hope everybody has the pages at this point that were distributed, and if not, could you look on with someone who has these pages? They will be essential. Are there any of the pages left over from either side? We're going to need more. More are being manufactured. All right. As I say, more are being prepared, and as soon as they're ready, they'll be distributed. I'd like to begin with a discussion of a Talmudic passage in Masechet Avodah Zarah 10a. Those of you who have it in front of you, fine. If not, I'll present the essence of it. And as soon as it's available, you'll have it in your hands. It's the third page. It's the third page of the three pages that you should have in front of you. The Mishnah in Masechet Avodah Zarah says basically that 3 days before a pagan festival, a Jew may not engage in any business activity with a pagan. And the Mishnah eventually goes on to list the names of the pagan festivals, so we will know how to properly apply the rules and regulations governing doing business with pagans 3 days before a pagan festival. And when the Mishnah lists the pagan festivals, it turns out that most of these names are names that we know very well from Roman literature. These are essentially Roman holidays. And we now pick up the discussion on 10a. It's in brackets on the page before you. V'yom genusia shel malcheihem. And among the various festivals that one may not do any business even 3 days before the festival with a pagan is a festival called Yom Genusia of their kings. The Gemara asks, "Mai v'yom genusia shel malcheihem?" What is the festival of their kings? Amar Rav Yehuda, "Yom shema'amidim bo ovdei kochavim et malkam." This refers to the day that they inaugurate a king, when they appoint a new king. The Talmudic discussion continues. Presumably, understanding genusia as genus, the Latin word for beginning. V'atanya yom genusia v'yom shema'amidim bo et malkam. But in the list of the festivals, it says Yom Genusia, that's one festival, and the second festival is Yom Shema Midinbo et Malkam, when they inaugurate their kings. Clearly, then, these are two separate festivals, so we haven't solved yet what Yom Genusia Shel Malcheihem means. Lokashia, Talmud answers, this is not a contradiction. Hadidei Hadivrei. We're talking about two inaugurations of kings, apparently. One, the inauguration of the king himself. Second, when a king appoints his own son as successor. And that would happen during the lifetime of the king, presumably. That's another festival. So these are the two festivals that are meant. Umi mukne malka bar malka. And then the Talmud says, since when have we ever heard of the pagans appointing a son who succeeds his father. Mimukme Malka ben Malka. Here, there's no question we're talking about the Romans. What the Talmud has in mind here is the Roman emperors, who by and large did not succeed their fathers, or fathers were not succeeded by their children. The Senate would elect the emperor. So the Talmud asks quite correctly, Umi Mukme Malka bar Malka, where do we find that a father is succeeded by son? And we can prove that this is not the case. Vatani Rav Yosef, Hinei Katon Taticha Bagoyim. I'm going to read the whole biblical verse first, and then we'll go back to the Talmud. Bazuyata Ma'od. This is a verse from the book of Ovadia, which consists of one chapter in Tanakh. And the book of Ovadia, those of you who remember, is devoted to a prophecy directed to Edom. And in that prophecy, the second verse reads, as we read it here in the Talmud, Hine katon taticha bagayim, you are the smallest of the nations. And the end of the verse is Bazuya tamaod, and you are a despised, a very much despised people. The Talmud interprets each part of the verse. Hine katon taticha bagayim she'ein moshivin melech ben melech. You are the least of the nations. Why are you the least of the nations? Because unlike other nations where father is succeeded by his son, in this nation, the nation of Edom, Ein Moshivin Melech Ben Melech, a father is not succeeded by his son. Bazuya Tamaod, and why are you a despised nation? She'ein Lahen Lo Ktav V'lo Lashon. You have neither script nor language. So we're left with a kind of a problem, and I'm not going to worry about the context of the Talmud here. The Gemara then says, Elamai Yom Genusia Yom Haleda. The Gemara finally understands exactly Genusia, as in the word Genesis. What is Yom Genusia? Genusia means birthday, the birthday of the king. So it says Yom Genusia Shel Malchehem. It means not the day he's inaugurated as king, but it's another festival, and the festival intended here is the birthday of the king, which was a pagan festival, and all the rules and regulations governing pagan festivals applied. But I'm interested in the Talmudic passage here, how this verse was interpreted. And that second part of the verse, Bazuya Tamaod, and remember we're talking about presumably Edom, and I've already given away that it's not just Edom we're talking about here. It's very clear from the names of the festivals we're talking about Rome. The Talmud says, She'ein lahem lo ktav v'lo lashon. They have neither script nor language. This is incredible. They have neither script nor language. We all are well aware of the fact that there's a script known as the Latin script. We're so well aware of it, in fact. What do we know about the English language? We use it. We borrowed it. The English alphabet is essentially like we use Latin script, as do all Latin countries, as do most countries in Europe. German uses for German the Latin script, and so on. French uses the Latin script. The various Romance languages are written in Latin script. Inlam Ktav, the Romans don't have a script, but the Talmud doesn't know about Latin. And not only do they only have a script, but it says Inlam Ktav v'lo Lashon, they don't have a language. The Romans don't have a language. That's quite incredible. And anybody who studies the humanities and gets an advanced degree will in all likelihood read Cicero, and who knows, it's a vast Latin literature. What does this mean, She'inlam lo Ktav v'lo Lashon? So, thank God we have Rashi, and we turn to the bottom of the page. And Rashi knows it's talking about Rome. It's very clear, Rashi tells you that. And what does Rashi say? And it's on the line for you. Ktav v'lashon shel romiyim uma acheret balahen, acherim tiknu lahen kol sifrehem. Rashi says that the script and the language of the Romans came to the Romans from another nation, me uma acheret balahen, Acherim tiknu lahen kol sifrehem, and others wrote all their books for them. So Rashi. Now let's take Rashi word by word. Ktav lashon shoromiyim meyuma acheret ba'alahem. I have no real problem with that. Rashi says that yes, Rashi is well aware that there's a Latin script. He's well aware that there's that Rome existed, that they had an alphabet, and that they use that script, and indeed that there's a language, the Romans spoke Roman, no doubt about it. But what Rashi says is, and presumably Rashi had some historical source that informed him that this language and this script, these were borrowed by the Romans from other sources, which may well be. There's a lot of scholarship on the relationship between the Latin script and Etruscan and Greek sources for much of the Latin language and so on. So it may well be that that's what's intended here. So Rashi's explaining that the Ktavim D'Lashon of the Romans came to them from another nation. But Rashi continues and says, Acherim tiknu lahen sifrehem. Others, other peoples, other persons, wrote their books for them. This is incredible. If you want to claim that the script was borrowed from some earlier people, if you want to claim that the language was borrowed from earlier people, you could make that claim. But to say that their books were written by other peoples, that's incredible. That flies in the face of the hard evidence that we have in hand. We have Latin literature. We have Pliny's history. We have Cicero's orations. These are written in Latin. These were written by Romans. We have early manuscripts of these works. To claim that others wrote their books for them, this is incredible. Not only is it not true in fact, it's a gratuitous insult in terms of what Rashi is saying here. Because what did the Gemara say? The Gemara said, all the Gemara said was, She'ein lo ktav lo lashon. The Gemara didn't say that they didn't write books. All the Gemara said is they don't have a script and they don't have a language. Fine, so they borrow the script and they borrow the language. Once you borrow a script and you borrow a language, you can write all the books you like. So we borrow the Latin alphabet, we write books in English. It's not even solving the problem in the text. This is all these words here are meaningless. Rashi here is making a statement that not only is historically not true, it seems to be superfluous. It does nothing, adds nothing to the Talmudic passage. Well, we're going to leave that, and if I have time, we'll come back to it at the end of the presentation. Let's go to the first page. Incorporated in the Jewish code of law to be Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch Orachayim Siman Tav Kuf Tei is a curious list of fast days. The earliest version of this list that's come down to us is from the post-Talmudic period. It's from the 8th century. And that earliest copy is what you have on the first page in front of you. So if you'll take a look at it now, this is what is known as Sefer Halachot Gedolot, a work from the Gaonic period, as early as the 8th century. And this list, as you see it, is more or less incorporated into the Shulchan Aruch, where I just indicated a list of official fast days. And as far as I know, there are no Jews that fast on these fast days. We'll come back to that a little later. But in any event, this list, as you look at it, and we'll see, begins with a strange line, Elu yamim shemitanim bahem min haTorah. These are fast days that we fast, apparently, the technical term among the Lumdim would be midyoraita, from the Torah. What's strange is, of course, none of these fast days are mentioned anywhere in the Torah, but we'll worry about that later, too. Here's a list of fast days. Then it goes on to list among the fast days, the eighth day of Nisan in line 2, for example, that the day, the yard site of Nadav and Avihu. Notice the tenth day of Nisan in line 2 is a yard site that is Basarabo Meta Miriam Hanaviyah. Apparently all Jews are supposed to fast on a day that Miriam, a woman, died. And this is incorporated in the Shulchan Aruch and so on in the list, continues. What we have, in effect, is a list of tragic events, mostly anniversaries of date of death, of a variety of biblical figures, rabbinic figures, and so on. You can read through the list on your own. In almost each case, the date is given when the rabbi died, if we're talking about a rabbi, or when Rabbi Akiva was imprisoned, and so on. And that day is a fast day. included on the list are some fast days that all of us do observe, of course, and the yard site of Moshe Rabbeinu, Zayin Adar, as you can see at line 70. These are dates that will be familiar to most of you. Now, there are obvious questions that one needs to address to this rather strange text that we have in front of us. As I indicated, this is not in the Talmud. This is a post-Talmudic text. There is no evidence and no record anywhere in Talmudic literature, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Tosefta, Sifra, Sifrei, Mechilta, and so on, that anybody fasted on any of these days. Most of these days aren't even listed. They're not even mentioned. But suddenly, in the 8th century, we have a list of fast days. And some of the important questions that scholars address when they read a paragraph like the one you have in front of you is, who authored this? When was it authored? Where does this come from? Does this originate in Babylonia, for example? After all, the oldest text comes from the 8th century. Did Jews ever fast on these days? Which Jews? Which communities? When? And so on. Why are these yard sites commemorated? Why are these anniversaries of death remembered? And there are some major biblical figures here, as you can see as you read through it. But why are many others not mentioned here? Nadav and Avihu's date of death is a fast day, apparently, but not the date of death of Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, or Yechezkel, for whatever reason. The martyrdom of Rabbi Hanina Sagan HaKohanim is listed here, but Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, who all Talmudists will be familiar with, a great martyr, and description of his martyrdom in Sechet Sanhedrin, he's not mentioned here. What rule of thumb was used by the editor or whoever it was to decide what would be a yard site worthy of a fast day and what would not be worthy of a fast day? There are halachic problems. The first line, as I indicated, said these are fast days from the Torah. Literally, they're not in the Torah, and they certainly don't carry Torah authority. Nowhere does the Torah obligate someone to fast on the yard site on the anniversary of the death of a famous rabbi or a famous heroic figure. Halachically problematic are some of the dates listed here, which if you looked at all the dates, if you had the time to do it, and you can do it on your own, you would see that some of these fast days fall on Rosh Chodesh, some of these fast days fall on Chanukah, and as a fact, there's a Mishnah, there's a clear Mishnaic teaching, Mishnah Ta'anit, that says that Ein Gozrin Ta'anit Ala Tzibur, B'Rosh Chodesh, B'Chanukah, B'Purim, and so on. So, by rabbinic literature, one is prohibited from fasting on some of the very days listed in this list. Yet this list is incorporated in the Shulchan Aruch. Even more enigmatic, and this is not something I will discuss tonight, but it's again for the halachists to worry about, Rabbi Yosef Karo incorporated this. As I say, this is in every Shulchan Aruch. This is in your Mishnah Berurah. You go home, you'll find it there toward the end of Or HaChaim. But Rabbi Yosef Karo, in his commentary on the Tur, in his longer work, the Beit Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo says as follows, Lo ra'iti me'olam ve'lo shamati mishenahag litanot bahem. Rabbi Yosef says, I never heard of anyone ever fasting on any of these days. And then he incorporated it in the Shulchan Aruch. I'm sure there were, but he wasn't Sfat. Oh, okay, all right. But the Shulchan Aruch, it's in the Shulchan Aruch. I'm going to focus tonight, just because I have mercy on everybody and we would like to go home at a reasonable hour, on just one line in this text. The line is underlined for you, so if you look in the middle of page 1 where it's underlined, which begins at line 66, which is the most enigmatic passage in this text. Bishmona Bekevet, Nichtava Torah Bimei Talmai HaMelech Yivanit, V'achoshech Ba Leolam Shlosha Yamim. So you're supposed to fast on the 8th day of Tevet. I take it many of you probably did. B'tish'a Bo, and you're supposed to fast the next day on the 9th day of Tevet. B'tish'a Bo Lo Katu Rabotenu Amahu, U'bo Bayom Meit Ezra HaKohen Nechemye Ben Chachalia, Ba'asarabo Samach Melech Bavel Yushalayim, etc. So you're supposed to fast on the 8th, 9th, and 10th day of Tevet, 3 consecutive days. But now you understand why many people don't fast on these fast days. I'm interested in that Tisha B'Av. Now, every date that's listed here is accompanied by an explanation as to why one fasts on that day. The only exception is B'Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Tevet, with a very enigmatic statement, you should fast. Lo katvu raboteinu al mahu. But our rabbis decided not to write, record why. You fast on the ninth of Tevet. You're going to fast on the eighth and the tenth. You might as well fast on the ninth also. All right. And then it goes on and says, Ubo bayom, but on the ninth day you should know that Meit Ezra HaKohen Nechemya ben Chachaya. In any event, it is the yahrzeit of Ezra and Nechemya, but as we shall see clearly, as it's formulated, that's not the reason why you fast. Now, this is a riddle that has exercised the minds and interests of the greatest rabbis through the centuries. So if you'll turn out of page 2, we're going to look at the best that's been said, a quick survey of the best that's been said as to how do we understand this strange fast day on the 9th of Tevet. The first rabbinic scholar recorded in Jewish literature to address the issue was the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daud. Not the Ravid who wrote glosses to the Rambam's Mishnei Torah, but another Ravid, a contemporary of his, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Daud, who wrote a famous historical work called Sefer HaKabbalah. He died in the year 1180. And you can read the passage, you have it in front of you. After a vivid portrayal of the court intrigue that led to the death of Rabbi Yosef HaLevi HaNagid. Rabbi Yosef HaLevi HaNagid was the son and successor of Shmuel HaNagid, the vizier of Granada, and Rabbi Yosef succeeded him as vizier of Granada. He was assassinated. Rabbi Yosef HaNagid was assassinated on the ninth day of Tevet in the year 1066. That is a historical fact. The Ravid, writing after this event and knowing about this event, then noted that it was no accident that the rabbis of yore had decreed that all Jews should fast on the ninth of Tevet. They, Beruach HaKodesh, knew that on this day the leader of European Jewry, Rabbi Yosef HaNagid, would be assassinated. And that being the case, they ordained a fast day in advance. So the Ravid. So in other words, Chazal had anticipated by divine inspiration the very day of Rabbi Yosef HaNagid's death. Now this first interpretation has much in its favor. First of all, it's a yahrzeit. And our list is a list largely of yahrzeits and tragic events in Jewish history. This was certainly a tragic event, and in Spain in particular, was remembered for long after as one of the tragic events in Spanish Jewish history. Rabbi Yosef was murdered by an Arab enemy, by the way, and therefore, in this sense, Rabbi Yosef was certainly a martyr. He dies al Kiddush Hashem and surely belongs, in a certain sense, on our list. The other point in favor of this particular interpretation is one can understand why the rabbis didn't explain why they had ordained this fast day. Because you could imagine if it had said that we're ordaining this fast day because Rabbi Yosef HaLevi HaNagid on the 9th of Tevet in the year 1066 will be assassinated. And you can imagine how Rabbi Yosef HaLevi would have felt every year as he learned this famous passage in the Jewish codes. Okay. Both? Or the only one? All right. The mic is not working. I can just try to speak without the mic. Is it working? No. This is not working.
No, I don't. Turn it a little higher. What?
How's that?
Okay, first let's see if I'm on. Let's check. Is it working?
It's not working.
Okay, if it starts, you give it to me.
You want something? The light one. How about there's no battery? The light's half.
Okay. I will try to speak as loudly as I can, so tell me if you can hear me. Can you hear me? Okay. Sorry. There's one fatal weakness, at least one fatal weakness with this interpretation, and that's why I will dismiss it very quickly. And that is that if we're going to allow in our list names of great rabbis who would be assassinated long after the list was authored, if we're going to allow for Ruach HaKodesh here, then I'm afraid that Gdolim V'Tovim, the Rav Yosef HaLevi HaNagid, died al Kiddush Hashem in almost every generation. And our list is much too small. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman should also be on our list. And one can go to every century in Jewish history and find, unfortunately, great Jews, great leaders of the Jewish people who died al Kiddush Hashem. They're not on our list. So I'm afraid that I'm not going to be persuaded by passage 2, the top passage on the pages that you have before you. So we move to passage 3. The Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, in his commentary on Megillat Esther, and it's spelled out for you, the 2:16. The verse reads, Vatilakach Esther el Hamelech Achashverosh el Beit Malchuto b'chodesh ha'asiri hu chodesh tevet. Very interesting. We read it every year on Purim. So she was taken, Esther was taken, and the verse says she was taken in Chodesh Tevet. Who cares what month she was taken? It has absolutely no role in Megillat Esther. Connects to nothing that comes after or before. No one in this room could care less whether it was Tevet, Shvat, or Adar. Yet, the Ramah says, of course, if the verse goes out of its way to inform us that she was taken in Chodesh Tevet, surely it must be significant. And the significance, explains the Ramah, is very simple. She was taken on the ninth day of Tevet. And the day that she was forcibly taken, this Jewish woman who now would have to lay down her virtue and almost her life for the Jewish people, this day is commemorated as a fast day for all time. Okay. Can you hear me? Very interesting, but you don't sound like you're persuaded. Okay. There are a lot of problems. First of all, Ikar Chasei Min HaSefer. If the whole point here was that we have to know that it was the ninth of Tevet, and in fact, that's going to become a fast day, so the key fact that it was the ninth day of Tevet, the verse doesn't tell me that. The verse only reads that it was Tevet. And more importantly, and this will always trouble me as we look at every, what? Yeah, it turned out well, and what's the secret? So, Rabotendu lo katvu alma. Everything else, they gave me the reason why. You can't tell me, so tell me the reason why. Is Esther was taken? What's the problem? Well, they made a fast day on the ninth day of Tevet. Rabotendu lo katvu alma. In the 17th century, we go to passage 4, the Taz, Rabbi David ben Samuel Halevi, and the Magen Avraham, Rabbi Avraham Gundiner, two of the famous commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, in their commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, Ala Makom, both say that they're amazed that there are even Jewish commentators that are wrestling with this issue. It's very simple. Take a look in the Slichot that we cite on Asara B'Tevet, and that's to this day in the Slichot that we cite on Asara B'Tevet. It says specifically that B'Tisha Bo Meit Ezra, we say it in the Slichot, that Ezra died on the ninth day of Tevet. And Magen Avraham, as you can see, said the same thing. And that's the case. They both said, there's no mystery here. We fast on the ninth day of Tevet because it's the yahrzeit of Ezra. Well, you already know why I'm not persuaded. Why is this not a persuasive argument? Because the halacha, take a look at the original text of the Halachot Gedolot. You have it on page 1, where he went out of his way to say that Chazal didn't tell us why you fast on the ninth of Tevet. You fast on the ninth of Tevet, and on this day, Ezra and Nehemiah died. The clear inference is that we're not fasting because of Ezra and Nehemiah. And the Chida, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai in his Pirkei Yosef and in other writings of his as well, where he discusses this passage, confronts the Taz and the Magen Avraham, and he says, we can't take seriously their argument. It's very clear this is not the reason why we're fasting on the 9th of Tevet. So we come to passage 5, which is a variation on the Ezra solution. This appears in one of the great classics of Drash, the Yarot Dvash of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeschutz, written in the 18th century. And those of you who can follow the Hebrew, read it on your own. I'll simply summarize it. Essentially, what Rabbi Yonasan says is that we are fasting because of Ezra's death on this day. We're commemorating his death, his yahrzeit. And what Rabbi Yonasan adds here is that the rabbinic reticence in spelling out the reason why we fast on this day has to do with the fact that Ezra, in many ways, and in rabbinic literature, is certainly often referred to as a second Moses. There are parallels between Ezra and Moshe Rabbeinu. And just as it is said concerning Moshe Rabbeinu that no one knows his burial place to this very day, there are secrets about Moshe Rabbeinu, so too the publication of the date of death of Ezra was withheld by the rabbis, remained a secret. Well, what do you say? You're persuaded?
Moshe's death is public.
Okay, very good.
Good, terrific.
You don't have to go any further. Okay. If we're looking for parallels between Ezra and Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe's yahrzeit is listed here. And we know precisely when he died. He died on the 7th of Adar. If you want to draw the parallel, then would be, by all means, they should list the date of the yahrzeit of Ezra, and it's 9th of Tevet. It should be mentioned explicitly. If there's going to be a parallel, the parallel is going to have to be that just as we don't know where Moshe is buried, we don't know where Ezra is buried, if you want to make that claim. But if you're drawing analogies to Moshe, Moshe's date of death is spelled out clearly in this very passage. So we're not going to be persuaded by passage 5 either. Now, when the traditional avenues of Jewish interpretation were more or less exhausted, yielding few results, Jewish scholars began to turn outside of the Jewish sources to see whether there are outside sources that can shed light on this difficult passage. Ultimately, interpret we must. And this resulted in a curious turn of events with regard to Jewish intellectual history, namely that this is one of those instances, and there are a handful of them, one of the instances where a Christological interpretation was given to a Jewish text. And the founders of what's known as Wissenschaft des Judentums, Leopold Zuns, Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, and others, who read widely in Jewish literature, discovered passage 6. So take a look at passage 6. Passage 6 is by a famous Spanish philosopher and astronomer, Rabbi Avraham Barjia. He died in the year 1136. And he wrote a book called Sefer HaIbur, a major astronomical treatise. And in that book, and you have the passage in front of you in Hebrew, you can look at it, and do look at it carefully, he wrote, and this passage, it was written in the year 1122 in Spain, he wrote that Yeshu was born on December 25th. Which, by calculation, he was a master astronomer, he knew the Jewish calendars, he knew the calendars of the Roman period as well, and he made a calculation to see when December 25th would have fallen on in the alleged year that Yeshu was born. And he says, December 25th, in the year that Yeshu was born, fell on the 9th day of Tevet. The 9th day of Tevet. This is in the passage you have in front of you in passage 6. And what the modern scholars said, the first modern Jewish historians, was that in the light of passage 6, they discovered the manuscript and published this manuscript of Sefer HaIbur. In the light of this passage and in the light of Rabbi Avraham Barjia's calculation, they concluded that now we understand this famous passage that's incorporated in the Shulchan Aruch, Or HaChaim Siman Tav Kuf Pei, that the fast of the 9th of Tevet commemorates the birthday of Yeshu. We fast on the birthday of Yeshu. And due to the influence of these 19th century founders of Yiddish and Wissenschaft, this solution became the solution that's to this day available in most Jewish histories, multi-volume Jewish histories that even bother to address the issue at all. I'm not persuaded. And once again, because otherwise I'll have nothing to say. Susie? Presumably, whoever wrote this list fasted. We have the evidence. And as you heard, the Rabbi Shammah said, in fact, in Tzfas, there was a small group of Jews, and we know exactly who they are, who fasted on these days. So there were people who fasted. Don't worry about that. Right? We don't fast today. For whatever reason, Orthodoxy has decided not to fast on this day, but that there were Jews who fasted on this day is a very famous Kabbalistic work called Sefer Reishit Chochma, Rabbi Leo Divi Das. And the Reishit Chochma, it says specifically that I fast on this day and all pious Jews should fast on this day. So maybe we're not as pious as some others, but there were Jews who fasted on this day. That you don't have to worry about. I'm concerned now specifically with the claims of passage 6. Now, first of all, if he's right, and then in essence what we're saying is that the author of this 8th century text, and it may be older, the Baal HaLochos Gedolos recorded this passage in the 8th century. It may reflect Jewish practice in Eretz Yisrael in the 5th century, 4th century, even though it's not mentioned in the Talmud. And I actually have some evidence that that's the case, but we're not going to spend much time on it. But if he's right, then the claim really is that there were Jews living in the 8th or 7th century or 6th century who knew that Yeshu was born on the ninth day of Tevet. There's no Christian record, by the way, that Yeshu was born on the ninth day of Tevet. But you have to claim that Jews somehow kept this record and remembered the ninth day of Tevet, and knowing that it was a tragedy for the Jewish people, ultimately, Christianity, after all, broke off from Judaism, would persecute Judaism, it would become the Holy Roman Empire and the religion of the Holy Roman Empire. Jews suffered enough at Christian hands, even early on, that it may well be that somebody might have wished to commemorate this as a fast. But that's the claim. But one has to wonder whether there were any Jews in the 7th or 8th century who would have known or cared what day Yeshu had been born on. How accurate is this suggestion in passage 6 that December 25th, in the year, let us say, for argument's sake only, the year 3 BCE, because modern scholarship accepts 3 BCE as the correct date of birth of Yeshu. Let's say that 3 BCE, do we really know? Is there any way we can know that December 25th fell on the ninth day of Tevet? We have no such correlations, and we're talking about a period during Bayecheni times where, on the basis of testimony, it was decided whether a month would have 29 days or 30 days, and one could never predict whether that testimony would appear or would not appear. Could we really calculate by any mathematical method with any kind of certainty that the 25th of December was actually the ninth day of Tevet? And if even it's correct that there is an equation between 25 December and the 9th of Tevet, would Jews commemorate a birthday? Do we have any parallel anywhere in all of Jewish literature, all of halachic literature, that we commemorate as a fast day, a birthday? When after the Holocaust, there was much discussion in halachic circles and in Zionist circles whether to how to establish a memorial for the Holocaust and what's the appropriate day, and whether it should be Yom HaShoah V'Hagvurah, and whether it should be Asar B'Tevet, or it should be no day, and so on and so forth. All the different suggestions that were made, Chaf Zayin Nisan, Asar B'Tevet, Tisha B'Av, separate days. Nobody suggested the birthday of Hitler as a day that someone should commemorate as a sad day in terms of the Holocaust. So when do we commemorate the birthday of an enemy of a Jew? As sad as that may be, Hayitochein, this is so strange. Maybe, but do you have evidence? Well, was anyone? First of all, I'm not so sure that's the case. But that they weren't Germans or Nazis who weren't celebrating his birthday, I don't know. Maybe someone here knows that, but I doubt it. This is very, very strange. And now look at passage 6. Hold it in front of you. Look at the Lashon of... Look at what Avraham Bichia actually says. V'hu nolad, notice, l'divreihem. Bishnat gimel alafim tovshin samech alef. L'briyat olam. Be'25 yemim echodesh December. V'hu yom Shabbat, yom tish'a b'teveit. And look what he says. V'ra'ui haya hayom hazel hivaleid bo harasha hazeh. Avraham Bichia says, this is a wonderful day for him to have been born on. Im divreihem emet. Very careful about Rabbi Bichia. Well, don't worry about it. That's who we're talking about. If you haven't, that's who we're talking about. You'll go back to the original passage. You'll see it there. Okay, there's no question about it. Who says we believe the Goyim? We believe the Goyim that Yeshu was born on December 25th. Why should I believe the Goyim that Yeshu was born on December 25th? He's saying, if we start with the Hanukkah that he was born on December 25th, then by my calculations, it will work out. And this is a wonderful day anyway. Sure begins to sound more like him, right? Shehem yadu yoma sheya b'chof hei b'december ki hadavar hazeh eino katuv lahem be'evangilayon. Doesn't say anywhere in the New Testament. Rabbi Chia knew his, you know, he read his literature, did his homework. Doesn't say anywhere in the New Testament that Yeshu was born on December 25th. No, no, I'll come to that. All right. What was just referred to is that while the Western Church celebrates the birthday of Yeshu on December 25th, and that's why last night was Nittel night here in the United States, for those who commemorate Nittel. In the Slavic countries, the Eastern Church celebrates the birthday of Yeshu January 8th. And that's because in the 4th century, when for the first time the question was asked in Christian sources, when was Yeshu born? There was a debate. There were two different traditions. Actually, there were more than two. There were many traditions, many different dates as to when Yeshu was born. But two became eventually accepted by the two different branches of the church. One is December 25th and one is January 8th. So if you lived in the Slavic countries in Europe, where the birthday of Yeshu was celebrated on January 8th, Nittel night was the night before January 8th. If you follow the Western countries, Nittel night is the night before December 25. And those nights, by the way, and I don't want to get back to Nittel because it'll lead us astray, but just you should know, those nights were dangerous nights for Jews in Christian countries. They were dangerous nights in particular because Christians had to go to midnight mass. They stayed up that night late. And so long as they were up at night, how do you stay up for midnight mass if you don't ordinarily learn Torah every night? You go to the bar, you drink. It's a night where Jewish life was in danger. A Jew seen on the streets, his life was in danger. And so Jews didn't commemorate, by the way, the birthday of Yeshu, Chas v'Shalom. What Jews did was, is they had certain practices of women not going to the mikveh that night, of men not going to the Beis Medrash that night, because to walk in the streets was to take your life in your hands. And when was it dangerous? It was dangerous when they celebrated. It has nothing to do with the Jewish calendar. The Christian calendar fixed Nittel night. So if you were living in... Nittel is a Jewish pun, a Hebrew pun for Dies Natalis, the day of birth. Natalis as in prenatal care. All right? So it really means that was a Latin term for the birthday, Dies Natalis, the day of the birthday of Yeshu. But we called it Nittel, commemorating in part the hung one, the one that was hung up that night. Which is part of, it's also a halacha. It's a halacha that when we refer to Avodah Zarah, we refer to it in that way. So Nittel night was, the practice was that there was no public learning of Torah on Nittel night. And for many Jews who didn't own Sfarim and so on, if you couldn't get to the Beis Medrash, essentially you weren't learning. And that was until midnight. And then midnight, when the Christians now were at midnight mass, there was no danger in the streets. At midnight, you could go out. At midnight, you could learn. And the meaning in many communities is, those who still practice this, is that they don't learn till midnight, but from midnight on, they learn Torah. And this is what the Chassam Sofer practice was in terms of Nittl. So Nittl was a... it was not even a commemorative in any way, as I'm trying to indicate. It was self-protective. For our own protection, we developed a practice of not learning Torah on Nittl night, whenever Nittl night was celebrated. Now, it was unclear when Nittl night was, and as I say, depending where you lived, you celebrated the one or the other. There are some Jews who have big machmirim, and they're not sure which night should be celebrated, so they don't learn on both nights, just to be on the safe side. All right. And the truth is, since we really don't know when Yeshu was born, if you're really a Machmir, so you never learn at night because we don't know when he was born. Passage. 19th century. In a gloss to the Shulchan Aruch, one of the great Gaonim, the Rav of Leipnik, Rabbi Baruch Frankel Teomim, the Baal Baruch Tam for the London present, a contemporary of the Chassam Sofer, Rabbi Akiva Eger, and others. He died in 1828. He wrote glosses to the Shulchan Aruch as well, and they're printed in very small print in back of the standard editions of Rabbi Yosef Karo's Shulchan Aruch. And I'm holding the text in front of me, and he writes as follows. Notice he was troubled by the passage. I'm wondering why we fast on this day, and obviously he was not satisfied, as we are not, with everything said till now, and he wrote as follows. The Hagos, called Hagos, Meagon, Moreno, Baruch Frankel, printed in back of the Shulchan Aruch. Simon Top Kufte, Baruch Hayim, Simon Top Kufte. Matzati Biktav Yad, as I found in a manuscript. Shebetet Tevet, Niftar Shimon Hakalpos, that on the ninth day of Tevet, Shimon Hakalpos died. Shehoshia et Yisrael b'tzara gdola, he saved the Jewish people during a great tragedy. Bizman ha-paritzim, in the time of paritzim is a technical term, but meanwhile I'll just render it sinners. Bizman ha-paritzim, nikba yom mitato, and the day of his death was fixed as a fast day, l'tanit olam b'Yerushalayim, in Yerushalayim. And any of you are welcome later if you want to come up and you can look at the passage right here. That's it. That's one witness. No one ever said this before. One witness, the great Gaon who found a manuscript, doesn't identify the manuscript other than to tell us what I just indicated to you. When I first discovered this, I was delighted because here was something. At least I had something that I could work with. But it's one witness. And as you know, al pishnayim edim yakum davar. I need two witnesses. And so I made search, and Baruch Hashem, I found a second witness. And if I could have the second witness is a sefer that was just reprinted here in Brooklyn by one of the reprint companies. An extensive commentary on the entire Talmud, on the entire Shulchan Aruch, called Ma'orei Or, multi-volume work. Ma'orei Or was written by a great rabbi in Metz. Metz is a city today in France, one of the great cities. His name, the author who wrote of this work, is Rabbi Aaron Worms. His name is Rabbi Aaron Worms, chief rabbi of Metz, from 1831 until his death in 1836. He was the successor to the Chagas Aryeh, one of the great Gaonim of modern times. And in this Ma'orei Or, and I'm holding the passage in front of me, on his comment to Shulchan Aruch Siman Tav Kuf Tei, so in the present new edition, this is Ma'orei Or, Volume 4. Ma'orei Or, Volume 4. Commentary to Shulchan Aruch Siman Tav Kuf Tei. I saw a memorial book. This means, again, a manuscript. There is no such book as Tolkien.
It's a little different from what I read before. It's a little
Kalponi.
It's the same
person named Shimon HaKalponi,
and clearly the same person.
Sheishlim la-Yehudim. Sheishlim la-Yehudim.
Praying through the praise. Sounds like made peace with the Jews, or something like that. We'll have to see what it means.
Ve-he-li-mo mit-ne-hem. But
remained
hidden because of them. This language here is very secretive. It says in Megillat Ta'anit, the rabbis didn't explain why. Clearly, they're referring to this passage in Sefer Zichronot. Sefer Zichronot indicates that Jews everywhere were fasting on a certain day because of Shimon HaKalponi. Did some service to the Jews, but it happened in secret, and so they didn't spell out the reason why. He makes the connection very nicely to our passage. The people of Yivat Hamid, good name for it, with the factory. Yivat Hamid, he says, well, this is actually the only other place to find in Jewish literature. They mention the fast day, and but the rabbis deliberately refuse to explain why we fast. Now I have two witnesses. For this event in Jewish history. Nowhere in Talmudic literature do we have a name of anybody by the name of Shimon HaKalpos or Shimon HaKalponi. These names don't occur, but
They occur elsewhere in Jewish literature.
The person intended by these two witnesses from the 19th century is clearly a person that's known to us from what's known as the Toldot Yeshu. We have a literature that's been preserved by our ancestors, Ashkenazim and Sfaradim, that gives our version of the early history of Christianity. And I'm holding one copy of the book in front of me, Toldot Yeshu. In this book, which has been printed on very rare occasions because it creates great danger for Jews. It's been censored by the Christian Church. Copies of this book have been burned. Actually, it's very hard today to acquire a copy of this book. I'm almost certain that if you leave this room and try to acquire a copy in your local storm store, even when it's open, you're not likely to get a copy of this book. Now, in this book, which gives our version of the early history of Christianity in beautiful Hebrew, a hero appears in many of the books. His name is Shimon, without another name. In some of the manuscripts, his name occurs as Shimon Kepha. In any event, this is a Tana from the Tanaitic period. And what happens briefly is the following. The first Christians rally around Yeshu and start a Jewish Christian movement. The first Christians were all Jews. They wore talis, they wore tefillin, they went to shul on Shabbos, they lived in the same communities as all other Jews in Eretz Yisrael. And you had a tremendous problem that you couldn't distinguish a Jew from a Jewish Christian outwardly. This was a problem that we know from the Gemara in general that the Gemara had to address, and Birchas Haminim was established in Talmudic times. A special blessing was added to the Shemona Esrei precisely to separate us from that group. It has to do in part with who leads the services. If you are a Jewish Christian, you would no longer lead the services if you had to curse yourself from the Umud, aside from all your colleagues. A very, very smart move on Chazal's part. And it was part of the movement to separate out from Jews Jewish Christians. Jews don't have to separate out Pauline Christians African Jews. They did it themselves. We're talking about Jewish Christianity, which is what Christianity was, until Paul came and instituted a different kind of Christianity. He's the one who instituted what's known as the abrogation of the law, so that Christians only essentially had to practice the Ten Commandments at best, and not the ceremonial law. Christians no longer had to be concerned about circumcision. They didn't have to worry about tallis, tefillin, and so on and so forth. That's a later period in Christian history. In the early period, Jews and Jewish Christians lived together in the same communities in Eretz Yisrael. And in the Toldot Yeshu, we're told that the Tanoim convene a meeting. The Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah of the first century convene. The names are actually provided. And they sit around the table, and what are we going to do? And, Shidduchim are taking place. It looks like a wonderful family. And only later you find out that this wonderful family is a Jewish-Christian family. Because outwardly, they went to the same young Israel as everybody else. How could you tell the difference? So at this meeting of the Tanaim, one Tana makes the suggestion. His name is Shimon. He says, we have no choice. We're going to have to infiltrate into Jewish Christianity. We will create a fifth column. One of us has to join the Jewish Christian movement, become very active in the Jewish Christian movement, rise to the top, and then when in a position of power, abrogate the law, change the nature of Jewish Christianity so no one will ever confuse a Jew and a Christian. The other Tanaim said, it's a wonderful idea, we volunteer you. And Shimon at this point says, great hesitation, he says, I'm prepared to do it, but I will only attempt it if you guarantee me a chelek in Olam Haba. And they undertake that responsibility for him. And so Shimon Kefa, or just Shimon in some manuscripts, joins Jewish Christianity in Yerushalayim. He becomes a major member of the sect. In fact, he is elected bishop of Jerusalem. Eventually, he is sent to Rome. And he founds the Christian church in Rome. And in Christian literature, he's known as Simon Peter. And he's called Simon Peter because Peter, Petros, means rock. And on this rock in Rome, they founded the Christian church, and he is the first pope. And in the Toldot Yeshu, this is a Tana. This is a Tana. And he then teaches. He creates the canon, the biblical canon of the New Testament. He decides which books would be included and excluded. He includes the Pauline epistles. He is the one who gives a stamp of approval to Pauline Christianity. And so the law is abrogated, and now you are a Christian only if you don't obey the ceremonial law of Judaism. There's a total separation now between Jew and Christian. You identify yourself either as Jew or Christian. There are no longer Jewish Christians. This is the basic story as it appears in Toldot Yeshu. Good question, and I'm going to come to it in a minute. Very old. Very old, all right? I'll come to it in a minute. Shortly. Now, we have very few copies of this book, by the way. It was printed on rare occasion. Actually, the first printing was done by Christians. They never allowed Jews to print this sefer. But we're not allowed to print it, but we had manuscripts. And our ancestors, as I remind you often, when they went from one exile to another exile, they didn't take their furniture. They took their Sifrei Torah, they took their manuscripts. They laid down their lives. And they preserved the manuscripts of this sefer. And one particular manuscript was published by Christians in 1705. The manuscript was preserved by Jews. But it was fell into the hands of a Christian by the name of Johann Jakob Huldrychus. And in 1705, Huldrychus published this manuscript enlighten, pollen, and I'm holding it in my hand. Sefer Toldot Yeshua Hamoshi, with Latin translation, Hebrew on one side. In this edition, and only in this edition, no other manuscript will exist. This manuscript was published in 1705, and it's probably still in the house. Some sofa, all these copies were destroyed during the house. But the book was printed in libraries, rooms, and so on. And the book is available in great collections and here tonight. For us to look at. So this is the Toldot Yeshu, the particular edition against, published by Hulderkurs, 1705. I know that doesn't sound very old, but we're going to investigate that. 1705. And in this edition, the name of the Tanah, who was sent by the other Talmudim to infiltrate, is Shimon Makalpa. The two great Gedolim that I mentioned, that they saw a manuscript and gave that name of somebody who saved the Jewish people in a time of difficulty. This is the man who saved the Jewish people in a time. And what did he save them from? From the Parid Sin. And I'll tell you that Parid Sin, which goes back to a word that's used prominently in Sefer Daniel, as the medieval Mepharshim all noted from the times of Sadi going on, Parid Sin refers to Jewish lawbreakers, ultimately becomes a term for Jewish Christianity. In the time of the Paritim, the Jewish Christians, Shimon HaKalpos saved the Jewish people. Exactly as I described to you. Yes, that's true, and that Sefer Hasidim knows that from Toldot Yeshu. I'm glad you're mentioning that, because what you're seeing by that comment, what was just said now, was that elements of this story already appear in a book known as Sefer Chassidim, written by the Yehuda Chassid, in the 12th century in Ravensburg, in Germany. So although I'm holding a 1705 edition, the material in here is much older and occurs as early as the 12th century. But I'll have more to say about that in No, he doesn't. No. Josephus Eusebius, did I hear? Eusebius, Christian historian, refers to Shimon HaKalpos, and he calls him the Bishop of Jerusalem. Yeah. And Eusebius brings us into the 3rd, 4th century. Well, I told you, this is, don't call me Testament, I'm talking about the Jewish theology. This is not a Roman Catholic version of the history of Christianity. Okay. This is our version. Okay. Now, much more detail is provided here. By the way, much detail about Joseph and Miriam and so on and so forth. Very, very fine details that occur nowhere else in Christian literature occur in this book. Yes? Different Shimon. Different Shimon, okay? Totally different Shimon. On page 126 of this edition of Toldot Yeshu, and only in this edition, and you have it in front of you, reads as follows. Vayamot Shimon, Vayitablu Bnei Yisrael et Shimon. Shimon died, and all Bnei Yisrael mourned his death. V'kavu yom mitato l'hitanot b'chol shana v'shana v'hu tet yamin b'yerach tevet. And it was established as a fast day for all of Jewry, the 9th day of Tevet. It is very clearly in our book. The next line reads, V'shar haparitzim asher b'Roma. The remainder of the Christians in Rome did whatever they did after he died. But Here's the story, yes. It's highly unusual. There's three successive fastings. That's, as I explained, is probably one of the reasons why we don't fast on this day. Okay. Now, there's no question that this is what's being referred to in the Shulchan Aruch when it says that we fast on the ninth day of Teves. Rabotenu lo katvu al mahu, but our rabbis did not want to reveal why. And you can understand, of course, why they didn't want to reveal. This whole story, this whole book was a book that we were persecuted every time we tried to publish. This was not something that you could make public and put in print. But I have a problem here. I have a very serious methodological problem. And that is, I brought evidence from a book printed in 1705. And it's here. You're all welcome to look at it if you like. I didn't invent this. It's right here. But our text is a Gaonic text. Our Shulchan Aruch goes back to the 16th century. The original text that you have in front of you on the first page goes back to the 8th century. I have to ask the question, as any historian would, maybe if you have evidence from the year 1705 that seems to be the source for something written in the 8th century, then it's the Nahapochu. In other words, it may be that since all of those passages that I presented to you didn't quite explain why we fast on the ninth day of Teves, somebody who wanted to explain why we fast on the ninth day of Teves invented a wonderful explanation after the fact. And that's what any historian would say, by the way. Any secular historian would say that. You can't bring evidence from the 18th century to explain a text that we have a copy of from the 8th century. That's a problem. But it's not an insurmountable problem. It's part of the reason you heard already. Because in this book, and only in this book that I'm holding in my hand from 1705, which gives much more detail about what it is that Shimon did when he came to Rome, it says that when Shimon came to Rome, he established which books would be in the Christian Bible. And when Shimon came to Rome, he eventually established the practice that this Bible would be written in Latin, that the language of the church would always be Latin. He even established the names of certain of the letters of the alphabet, so that by giving them a certain twist from the name that they were called actually in Roman times, Shimon was letting everybody know that in fact he was a fifth column, for those in on the secret, and that in fact he was the one who established the New Testament, the Latin version of it. He's the one who really established the liturgy of the Christian church. All this is in this Sefer. This is in the first century. No, this is the first century of Christianity, as described in this book during the first century. In the first century, Christianity was not the official religion of the Roman Empire. That's right, as described in this book. All that's part of this that I'm describing. When you say a medrash, what you mean is toldos yeshu. I'm aware of it. All comes from this literature. He didn't call it toldos yeshu. It's toldos yeshu. Okay? That is, you will not find this in Medrash Rabbah. You won't find this in...
Right. In a collection.
Absolutely. I'll be persuaded if you show it to me that it predates the Toldos Yeshu literature. I'm going to tell you now where you date this, okay? What it says in this book is that Shimon wrote all the books for Christianity. It says it here. Shimon gave them their script and their language, it says in this book. Now, Now go back to our passage. Rashi said that they don't have a Sav and they don't have a Lashon. And Rashi said it's referred to Romi. Who is Romi and who is Edom in Rashi, if anyone who reads Rashi regularly knows? For Rashi, it's Christianity. For Rashi, it's Christianity. Rashi could make sense out of that Gemara only by saying that it's referring to early Christianity. Not referring to Rome. It's referring to Christian Rome. And in Christian Rome, Rashi says, the language of Christianity is not their language. They have neither Ktav nor Lashon. Others gave them that Ktav nor Lashon. That's what it says in this book. And not only did others, when we're worried about that last part of Rashi where it says, Achirim, what does it say, the last part of Rashi? Achirim tiknu lahem, kol sifreihem. There's only one place in all of Jewish literature where that's stated. In this 1705 edition of Toldot Yeshu. And now what I want you to know is, that the Rashi on the page that you have in front of you and in every edition of the Vilna Shas is a censored Rashi. Of course it makes no sense. Of course we had a problem with it because you don't have the whole text of Rashi in front of you. But if you go and get yourself a copy of the Sefer called Yiktukei Sofrim, or if you get yourself an edition of the Talmud that's now being published, by the way, which includes all the missing passages that were censored out by the Christian Church, and open up to Avodah Zarah Daf Yud, and open up to what the Rashi really wrote. And I just happen to have a copy with me. I'm going to read it in translation. This is Rashi's words. Manuscripts of Rashi to the Sechet Sanhedrin over here. Beginning is exactly what you have. You can hold it in front of you. The script and the language of the Romans were borrowed from another nation. Yochanan and Shimon and others, all of them Jews, wrote their books for them. Others wrote their books for them, namely Yochanan, Shimon, all of them Jews. Language, script and language refer to grammatica, the Latin spoken by priests. They, the Jews, transformed the Romans language into an obscure one in order to separate them from Israel. They, the Jews, were not apostates. They acted from the best of intentions so as to benefit the Jews. When they saw that the Jews were oppressed by the deceitful acts of the followers of Yeshu, they impersonated priests and ordained all the Christian laws, customs, and books, as it is stated explicitly in the Tliat Yeshu narrative. That's the full text of Rashi, the uncensored text of Rashi. Rashi had... Now this text... Only one copy survived until 1705 with the name Shimon HaKalpos and was published in 1705. Manuscript and written. The title of this book is Toldot Yeshu, but many other manuscripts use there are different titles of these manuscripts, and some of them are called Tliat Yeshu. It's the same book. There's no question. We have different manuscripts today of Toldot Yeshu. We have Kairogniza copies. We have copies in Aramaic, not only in Hebrew. Because we have early Aramaic copies, but we only have portions, early portions. We don't have the complete book. Little scraps have come down to us through the ages. And some of these scraps that we actually have can be dated by radiocarbon dating to the 10th century. The oldest real copies, original copies we have, are pieces of parchment and so on in Hebrew, some in Aramaic, from the 10th, 11th century, just small fragments. The whole book has survived only in late manuscripts, and this particular version only in the printed book that I'm holding in my hand. There is no question this is the book that we're talking about. Now, I want to just add, since we're here with being sponsored by our colleagues, Rabbi Shammah, Rabbi Barry, in this particular institute, I want to assure you this was well known in Spain. And there's a passage in a famous halakhic work, I should say a famous halakhist who wrote halakhic works. This is Rabbi Yehuda ben Barzilai al-Barzaloni. Rabbi Yehuda ben Barzilai al-Barzaloni was a great Spanish author in the 11th century. He wrote a sefer called Sefer HaIkim, a major halakhic work at that time. And I'm holding this Perush on Sefer Yetzirah. This is Perush Sefer Yetzirah. The Rabbi Yehuda Barzaloni, he lived in the end of the 11th century. Page 146. Here, there's no question. The scholars, nothing to argue about. We have the manuscript. We're talking about a manuscript written by a great Adam Gadol we know about. He's cited by all later Rishonim and so on. He's a great figure in the history of Spain. Page 146 of his Perush al Sefer Yetzirah. He says as follows. Hashem shata motzei kol ha'otiyot ha'kodesh b'chokhma v'al ha'seder, kach ata motzei otiyot shebadu acherim miliban kigon otiyot ha'to'im. Aside from the Hebrew script, there's also the Latin script. And this Latin script, badu acherim, others invented, miliban kigon otiyot ha'to'im, zulatan. Shehotziyu mishalanu mishara otiyot mashematzu. He goes on and describes the script, and then he says as follows. Listen carefully. Roda tamotzei sheyesh len chof gimel otiyot. The Latin script has 23 letters. He says yud mikan the yud mikan, 10 at each end. If you divide it down the middle. V'shlosha be'emsa, and three letters in the middle. The otan gimel, the three middle letters of the alphabet, she'emsa hein, and he writes as follows. Aleph yud lamid, what do you think that is? Very good, L. Aleph yud mem, M. Aleph yud nun. That's what it says. It's very strange. It says there are three letters, and they call them L, M, N. V'fisha otam she'tiknu lahem otiyot, because those who created this alphabet for them, those who created knew that there's nothing serious about these people. Who are we talking about, do you think? Christianity, as you'll see in a minute. So they hinted at it in the middle of the alphabet. They call God that person who's a human being. L'chach ba'u otan, so therefore the authors of this alphabet to Christianity, hitilu otan be'emsa, they put in the middle those letters, L-M-N, l'hakhish kol ta'utan, ve'idu ha'emet, be'idu ha'shalosh otiyot, she'ein lo ein. What they were trying to say is that the God of Christianity, has no mother. V'zehu, el, ein. Ain. This is with Yehuda, Rabbi Barzilai, al-Barzaloni, writing in Perush Sefer Yetzirah. Nowhere it says that Ain is a hint written on those who invented the script, that means that Ain. Ayin, in only one book in all three stories, you get right here on all the time. Holdersworth version of Kodesh Yosef, all he requested. This text, printed in 1705, Rashi had the text in Eskimo. Don't work for it? Well, I can't prove that the author of Halachot Gedolot had a copy of Toldot Yeshu in front of him. I can only get back to the 11th century, as you see. But at this point, there's no reason to be skeptical anymore. At this point, it's quite obvious that Toldot Yeshu is a very ancient work and reflects an ancient, and not the only, but an ancient Jewish perspective on Christianity. And it's one that was widely read and preserved in Jewish circles, and I don't doubt for a minute that the fast of the ninth of Tevet, as described here, is referring to this event. I kept you long enough. All I'll say is we had a very difficult Talmudic passage. I hope you now understand it, and we understand the Rashi. And at the same time, you heard about an ancient Jewish perspective on Christianity. Thank you very much.